This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and we're spending the time here with Professor Gulesa Karum, who is professor of law at Santa Clara University School of Law. He teaches constitutional and immigration law there and is co-author of a book called The New Immigration Federalism. And we've extended this, although we are going to talk about tariffs as promised, but I know many of you have questions, and so let's take some more of your questions and what you need to express here. Ted is on next. Ted, join us.
Yes, good morning. I've got a question. I'm 71 years old, and as a kid, I always remembered a program called the Bracero program that dealt with the immigrant workers who would come in on an annual basis, work for a few months, be able to go back and return every year. And it's been repealed, and I forgot exactly why, but I just never hear any reference about it. You hear about work visas, but I think that's mainly referring to high-tech people coming in from India or China.
Yeah, the Bracero program goes back. Give us a little of that history, if you could, Deep.
Sure. The Bracero program was started in 1942, and it was in force from 1942 to 1964. And as your caller indicates, it was a program of seasonal migratory labor, allowing United States agricultural industry people mostly to bring in labor from Mexico on a seasonal basis, and they went back. Now, there were significant, the program ended in 1964 for a couple of reasons. One, there were significant labor abuses within the program, which caused a significant concern about it. But also in 1965, the United States completely revamped its immigration laws so as to create what we think of as a more equal system of immigration that did not favor any one country or any one region over another. And that's essentially the immigration law that we have today. It got rid of national origin quotas, etc. And so in some sense, the Bracero program had to be dismantled in anticipation of that program. But there are vestiges of it still. There is a temporary worker program for high-skilled workers, which everyone knows about, H-1B. But there is also a temporary worker program for low-skilled agricultural workers as well. But the numbers are quite low and certainly do not meet the labor needs of the United States, which is one of the reasons you have significant unlawful migration into the United States.
And a reminder that we're talking, we're taking your questions about the U.S. asylum process and anything you'd like to say. Here's somebody from Tiburon named Ross who actually has some strong words. Go ahead, Ross.
Yes, thank you. Appreciate you taking the call. I guess I just feel like the lack of action by Congress on both sides for at least a couple of decades has allowed this administration to take these kind of steps, and I just wonder why, a clear problem with policy that affects so many people living here in this country, whether legally or illegally, has been, universally discarded by both Democrats and Republicans for so long. And I'll take the response to that off the air.
Okay. Thank you for the call. Well, the can has been kicked down the road quite a bit here, hasn't it?
Sure. I mean, think about the last time there was any major immigration reform in Congress was 1996. And at that time, that so-called reform was almost all punitive towards non-citizens. Since then, there has been no significant or any real congressional action on immigration. It's become one of those polarizing issues like abortion, like other types of issues that divide people immediately. That used to not be the case. This administration, again, has used the wiggle room that they see within the statute to enact this policy. But make no mistake, it is a conscious policy choice. They have several alternatives that they could use instead of this type of separation. They could release people on bond. There's ankle bracelet monitoring, telephonic monitoring, etc. But yes, the caller is right that in the absence of strong congressional guidance here, this is what allows the administration and the executive to run roughshod over our basic constitutional values.
Well, here's Sherry, who has a key question, wants to know what recourse there is for citizens. Sherry, go ahead.
I'm exactly wondering that the recourse that we have as citizens to pressure the Trump administration to discontinue this violation of human rights, especially these are only misdemeanors. So, why are they, criminalizing these asylum seekers? But how can we stop them? And I'll take my answer here.
All right, Sherry, thank you for the question.
So I always tell my constitutional law students that the three most important words of the Constitution are the first three, that is, we the people. I think it's important, as your caller points out, to note that this is being done in our name as the American people. If we're, you know, even if we're not horrified by those actions, I think as taxpayers, we should be concerned. The cost of this type of enforcement, the cost of this type of detention is astronomical. I'm not sure I have any magic bullet answers except to say that this is why civic engagement is so important in this time. I don't think, looking to the future, that the actions of this administration, especially this particular episode, they're not going to be judged well by history. But I think more importantly is whether our voters and how they will judge them in November, let's say, during the midterm elections.
Well, we should mention that President Trump's, according to the latest Gallup poll, numbers are higher than they've ever been previously. That's just for the record. A listener writes, of those detained so far, what percentage of parents have been able to reunite with their kids? Also, is this new zero-tolerance policy only being enforced on the southern border? What's happening at other points of entry to the United States?
As far as I can tell, it is only being enforced on the southern border of the United States. I do not have numbers as to how many people have been reunited. I can tell you that, as the New York Times is reporting, over the last 6 weeks, roughly 2,000 children have been separated from their families, or families have been separated. It's not clear how many, if any, have been reunited in that time.
Do we know how other countries, particularly in Europe, deal with this exact problem? Do any of them that you know separate parents from children?
I am not aware of any, but as I said, I'm not an expert in how European countries deal with it. I think that if they did, they would be subject to the same sort of outcry that is happening here. It is fundamentally inhumane, and it violates all the international treaties and conventions to which all of those European countries are also a part.
Another question from Tony, who says, I read in the Washington Post that one man committed suicide after his kids were taken away from him. What sort of health statistics is the federal government keeping? And also, what sort of congressional oversight do we have?
Right, these are all great questions. I'm not an expert in this. I can tell you that the American Pediatric Association and other medical associations have come out with policy statements on this, almost all of them universally condemning the practice because of the significant psychological burden that it puts both on the parents and the children, and the types of damage that are hard to undo later. But I am not an expert on what specifically has been said on that issue.
Let me get to another caller here while we have a moment or two. Medea joins us. Good morning.
Good morning. My question is that I've heard recent stories that there have been women and children that have been sexually assaulted in detention centers by ICE officials or Border Patrol agents. Do those individuals qualify for the Violence Against Women's Act or VAVA? And I'll take my question off here.
All right. Thank you for the question.
It's a great question. The idea and the problem of abuse of vulnerable populations underneath Customs and Border Patrol protection is not new. That has been a problem for as long as CBP has been detaining children and mothers and families in its facilities near the border. But what you have now is the opportunity for even more rampant types of abuse by CBP agents. That is not typically the type of claim that's going to get one a T visa or a U visa. It can create liability for the CBP and the CBP officials. Generally, when children come and they're being screened for whether they could be treated as victims of trafficking, they're being asked questions about where they're coming from, the type of people who are bringing them, and for what purpose they're being brought to the United States.
Joyce wants to know whether these hopeful immigrants are even notified before they reach the United States borders of entry that their children will be taken from them. I think the answer to that is probably no.
Not in any,
especially some of the ways they come over and across the border.
Right. Not in any specific sense, and not in any way that we can assure that they know that. And obviously, Attorney General Sessions has made several now press conference announcements and speeches in which he has announced this as the possibility of it happening. But you have to remember that what people are running from is homicide rates that, you know, pale, that nothing in the United States even comes close to, gang violence where people literally might be killed if they don't participate in those activities, domestic violence and other types of economic and social deprivation, that it's not clear that knowing these things in advance is going to make any difference in the desire and need for people to migrate to safer ground.
Deep, I appreciate very much your being with us. Thank you for all the illumination and light you've cast on this. We've answered a lot of questions, and I'm grateful to you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And we've been talking with Professor Deep Gulasekarum, professor of law at Santa Clara University School of Law, about U.S. asylum process. Stay with us. I'm Michael Krasny. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The trade battle between the world's two largest economies continues to heat up. Today, China accused the United States of extreme pressure and blackmailing after President Trump threatened to impose a 10% tariff on $200 billion of Chinese goods. The latest move by President Trump comes after the U.S. and China announced tit-for-tat tariffs last week on $50 billion worth of goods, including U.S. beef, poultry, tobacco, and cars. These tariffs are just the latest in President Trump's America First economic agenda, which has also included levying a global tariff on steel and aluminum imports with longtime trade partners Europe, Canada, and Mexico, which led to the G7 fallout between Canada's Trudeau and Trump, as well as his threats to further dismantle the North American trade agreement. Fears of a trade war drove the Dow down 400 points, or 1.6% in early trading today. We're talking about what these latest tariffs might mean for the U.S. economy, international relations, and for consumers like you and me. We're joined today by Anna Swanson, and she's trade and economics reporter at the New York Times, and we welcome her to the program. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Edward Alden, who is senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of Failure to Adjust, How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy. And welcome, Edward Alden.
Yeah, good to be with you, Michael. Thank you.
Good to have you with us as well. Let me begin, Anna Swanson, with you. There's a good deal of concern about trade wars, a lot of talk about trade wars. Are we really in a trade war, a trade skirmish, or are we just talking about language here?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of debate around that. But even some of the more skeptical people about that term are now saying that this does look like a trade war. And I mean, I think, you know, no matter what you call it, what's important to note about that distinction is that a trade war is basically a kind of self-sustaining cycle, a kind of vicious cycle, if you will, where one country's threats leads to retaliation by another country. And we're certainly seeing that kind of behavior, not just between the United States and other allies like the European Union, Canada, and Mexico, but especially in this more recent conflict with China, where the president, you know, first threatened $50 billion in tariffs. China has responded with its own threat of, tariffs on $50 billion of goods. And then the president yesterday, not just doubling down, but basically quadrupling down or more, saying that he would issue tariffs on an additional $200 billion of goods. And then if China responds to that, he would be willing to do another $200 billion. So at this point, the tariff threats, you know, if they all were to go into effect, everything that the president has threatened would cover, you know, nearly all of the goods that China does import to the United States, just a really significant portion of our overall trade now.
Let me ask you also, and I want to go to you on this as well, Ted Alden, about what this is going to do to consumers. I mean, it's a big question, I realize, but it's certainly on people's minds. And it could affect, well, in fact, Gary Cohen, former economic advisor to the president, says these tariffs could actually wipe out whatever economic gains were made from the tax cut.
Right. Initially, with the size of the tariff threats, it looked like it would just be a fraction of the tax cuts. But again, the president has escalated these threats so much that if they were to go all into effect, you are starting to see a kind of sizable impact here. I mean, the thing that's important to notice is that the overall impact on the economy and GDP is probably still pretty small, because trade is a pretty small proportion of the American economy in general. And this is, you know, not all U.S. imports and exports that are being affected. However, you can definitely see some prices increase for consumers on certain goods. You know, a 25% increase on something like a washing machine or a television is substantial for a consumer, as would be, you know, if a business is purchasing that product. And so it's not clear from the tariffs, you know, exactly who will absorb that effect. It could be the consumer. It could be the Chinese company that is selling that good abroad. It could be the American company that is buying it. But somebody has to pay it at a certain point. And so it will force up prices overall.
Although some of the things, let me go to you on this, Ted Alden, that have been highlighted in terms of exempt or not exempt, I mean, almost seem capricious. I mean, like blowtorches and things like that with China. Strange.
I mean, we're kind of at early stages here. You know, what the administration is trying to hit in the first round is mostly intermediate goods of one sort or another, not stuff that's sold directly to people in stores, but things that are used by manufacturers here in the United States. If we do see the next round of escalation, that's going to hit consumer products. It's going to hit clothing. It's going to hit television sets. And maybe we'll hit smartphones and a bunch of other things. Important to remember, though, that the threat here is a 10% tariff, which is not an enormously large tariff. I mean, a lot of companies could absorb that. Consumers might see only small impacts. And the impacts are going to be concentrated. You're seeing some, you know, companies that use steel and others that are getting hurt. But so far, the impacts are fairly modest. But we are in the early stages here. Remember, this administration is threatening to levy tariffs on imported automobiles. If that happens, consumers are going to feel it big time.
Now, this is all kind of tit for tat at this stage, but it seems to be escalating, doesn't it?
I think there's no question it's escalating. I mean, you know, Trump's style is very clear, right? He hits, and if you hit back, he hits back harder. And that's what he's been doing at every stage of this trade conflict. And it's hard to see exactly where it stops. I think the only way it stops from the U.S. end is if the pressure on the president becomes overwhelming. And we're not even close to that. I mean, because the economy is so strong, unemployment is so low, the president's got a lot of room to run. I mean, his approval ratings have now hit 45%. So I think this is going to be with us for some time, and I think we're going to see the damage start to escalate.
And what about the division between those who feel, I want to be local here for a moment, that Silicon Valley is going to be helped by this, and those who are very critical of what's going to happen, because a lot of that has to do, I know, with intellectual property and the concerns over intellectual property. How do you read it?
Well, I don't see any way that Silicon Valley is going to be helped by these tariffs. In fact, you know, the companies here in Washington are speaking out quite forcefully against them. You raise the larger problem of China's practices in the technology sector, including theft of American intellectual property, forced joint ventures in which U.S. companies have to transfer their proprietary technology. These are big problems for U.S. companies operating in China. You know, Qualcomm there in San Diego has run into a constant series of challenges in the Chinese market, as have Apple and Intel and others.
Yeah, but somehow, excuse me, I was just going to interrupt you. Somehow it was okay to send a lifeline to ZTE, Chinese electronics firm, as opposed
to... Yeah, that's a complicated one. Of course, Qualcomm is a big supplier of chips to ZTE, so it cuts both ways. I mean, I think you will get widespread agreement that there are a series of Chinese practices that are harmful to the U.S. technology sector, and those need to change. You will not get any agreement on these tactics. It's hard to find anyone in the tech industry who thinks that threatening these sorts of tariffs on China is going to force China to change these objectionable practices. In fact, China will probably double down on them and try to become more self-sufficient technologically to protect itself from this sort of thing.
Well, let me hear what you, our listeners, have to say about this. We're talking about China, U.S. exchanging tariffs, about what is really now being characterized as a real trade war. And I'd like to hear any questions you might have for our guests, Ted Alden, who's a senior fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations, and Anna Swanson, who's trade and economics reporter of the New York Times. We welcome your participation, and you can join us now at our toll-free number. That number to call, 866-733-6786. Again, feel free to be part of the program. 866-733-6786 is the number for your calls. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website and post any questions or comments you have there about the tariffs and about the, well, as we're now calling it, trade wars. Join us by email, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And please feel free to be part of the program. I'm wondering, though, if I could just find out from you, excuse me, Anna Swanson, about the supply chain and all this and jobs. I mean, there are a lot of things at stake. And outline for us, if you could, just what's primary in those two categories.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are many, many supply chains that snake back and forth, especially between the United States and China. And that's a really interesting part of the Trump administration's strategy, is that they actually would like, at least some officials in the administration would like to pull these supply chains kind of back into the United States. They don't really like, companies locating some of these operations offshore. And many companies on the other hand, will counter that this is what they need to do to be competitive in a global environment. The auto tariffs were mentioned earlier here. That is another measure that the Trump administration is threatening, tariffs that could be on perhaps as much as around $350 billion of auto parts that are imported to this country. And that's, of course, an industry that depends quite heavily on a global supply chain. So if the Trump administration does try to enforce kind of a reshoring of these industries, that could be very painful for multinational companies.
Let me go to our callers. John joins us first. John, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yes, I just wanted to say that in addition to the intellectual property theft and joint ventures which transfer technology to Chinese companies, essentially China started this trade war by having much higher tariffs on imported products and prohibiting American tech companies from operating in China. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for that statement. Ted Alden, agree with that China started this?
I do, but not exactly for those reasons. I mean, China actually lowered its tariffs quite substantially when it joined the World Trade Organization in 2001. The main problems with China have to do more with heavy subsidies to a whole range of industries and these practices related to technology transfer and IP theft that we've been talking about. I mean, U.S. technology companies have succeeded in operating in China. Many of them do. They just don't operate freely. They're forced to operate in joint ventures with Chinese competitors. And the worry is that over time, the Chinese companies acquire the capacity to develop these technologies indigenously, which squeezes our companies out and also, over the longer run, poses some kind of security threat. I mean, at the end of the day, the fact that we are the world's technological leader is at the basis of our national security. So there are longer term issues here. So no question, there are real problems that the U.S. is pushing back against. We should have pushed a lot sooner. It's just the methods being used by the Trump administration are potentially enormously destructive to ourselves as well as to other countries.
Let me go to another caller. Linda joins us next. Linda, you're on the air.
Good morning. Don't tariffs have to be passed by Congress?
How about that, Anna Swenson?
So, Congress has delegated a lot of authority to the president, and under these legal statutes that he's using currently, he does have very broad authority. Of course, Congress can always change the law and could choose to revoke that authority, and we have seen members of Congress kind of toying with that option in the last few weeks in proposed legislation. But those measures haven't gotten very much support from congressional leaders, Republicans, in part because they say that the president would simply veto those measures and then, you know, they would need a bigger vote to go ahead. But, you know, we may now see with things escalating with China, we may see more of a backlash from Congress. Many congressional Republicans there are more free trade oriented and are from states where producers or farmers are expecting to be hurt by these trade measures. So that could really could goad them into action as we see the midterms approach here.
Well, in terms of, for example, soybeans, Ted Alden, farmers already are being hurt and hurt a great deal throughout the country agriculturally with these tariffs. I'm wondering about the political effect of this. You said before, you mentioned the fact that President Trump is higher now in his ratings by the Gallup poll, 45% than ever before. But there's also that report that came out, which I think you probably are familiar with, from the Scotia Bank that says this could plunge United States, Canada, and Mexico into recession.
Well, the thing is we're quite a ways from that. The economy is as healthy as it's been in decades at the moment. One could say possibly a little too healthy because of the juice from the tax cuts. But
well, forgive me, the markets are good, but S&P is suffering somewhat. I mean, they're down.
Yeah, we can debate it, but unemployment, you know, is at the lowest level since the late 1960s. There are caveats there, but the economy's in pretty good shape. I mean, when it comes to the farm economy, a little less so. I mean, there's been some struggles recently in the farm economy, and we have seen the tariff threats hit soybean futures, for instance, which are, you know, down at a two-year low today. There will be some real impact. I mean, I've talked to some farmers and their representatives here in Washington. They have believed that the president would take care of them. I think their hope was that there would be a deal with China, which would involve China, in fact, buying a lot more soybeans rather than buying less. So the farm community has been willing to give the president some room here, but I think if the result is, in fact, retaliation, you could see some reconsideration in the Farm Belt about whether the president's policies are actually serving their interests or not.
And let me bring another caller aboard. We go to you, Wes, next. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you, and thank you to your participants. Hey, quick question. Jennifer Granholm, the former governor of Michigan, talked about how 8,000 manufacturing businesses left Michigan to go overseas. So the question is, how do we get here? That was a matter that was probably based upon free trade. They could make a cheaper product in China. And here we are now 20 years later wondering what went wrong and how to fix it. And tariffs are clearly not the right answer. But free trade, as it was practiced back in Michigan back in the 70s and 80s, didn't seem to help us out either.
Let me go to Anna Swanson on this. Anna Swanson?
Sure, yeah. So there is good economic research that shows that competition from China and China's entry onto the global stage as an economy did cost a lot of manufacturing jobs, perhaps millions of manufacturing jobs in the United States relocating to elsewhere in the world. I mean, the question is really, what can you do about that? You know, China is such a massive country that the entry of more than a billion people into the global marketplace was probably bound to have a very big shock on the global economy and affect the U.S. economy in some ways. Should the United States have taken a more aggressive approach to getting China to, you know, reform and open its market up? Perhaps. I mean, there are people who say that the United States could have used the WTO more effectively. And there is some agreement over, you know, now trying to change things with China. I think, as Ted mentioned, the disagreement is over the method, whether tariffs are really the best way to force the country to do something.
We'll leave it there. And I thank Anna Swanson and Ted Alden for being with us this segment. Quick response. I think I heard you talk there, though, Ted, quickly.
I was just going to say quickly, Michael, that my book spends 200 pages answering the caller's questions.
Yeah, I'll give your book another plug. Don't worry. It's called Failure to Adjust, How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy. Thank you both for a good segment, an important segment. And as we move ahead, we're going to talk about Hasidism in the next hour. Hasidims here in the United States almost entirely voted for Trump. Stay tuned for that. It's up ahead.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, who believe that all people deserve access to education and culture to enrich a lifetime of exploration and learning.